Later, the Mirheim-Meyer dimension. So what I want to do is finish that and then go on and describe classical sequential growth models
and talk about some of the consequences and some of the lessons that we can draw from them. So just to remind you where we were, I had defined a bunch of integrals a little farther away, so let me know if I'm ready too small. But you find about the
integrals, one for every, basically one for every finite causal set. And the integral just tells you something roughly like the abundance, if you were to sprinkle interval in Kupski space, the abundance of subcausal sets that coincide with the one you're asking about. So the very simplest one would be just one element causal.
So that's equal, the abundance of those is just the number of elements sprinkled into the interval. And remember, we're assuming that we'll sprinkle exactly n points into this interval. So in that case, the abundance is 1, sort of the normalized. So remember, this was defined as the integral of dx, by which I mean dnx in n dimensions. So this is an interval n-dimensional Minkowski space. And that's equal to 1, of course, because it's normalized. I shouldn't have said dv, it's just the normalized volume element. V is the total volume of this interval. So similarly, if we ask the similar integral corresponding to the two-chain causal set, that'll be double integral dx over d y over v, I call. And then this theta function, which is 1, x causally precedes y, and that I'll show you, I told you the answer, I'll indicate in a minute how you get the answer. It's just nothing profound. Just doing this integral over the appropriate region. And then for the K chain, so this is the two chain, this is the one chain if you like. And for the K chain, you won't actually need anything beyond 3 here. So this, by K chain, I mean a chain with 3 elements, with K elements in it. For the K chain, it's the same sort of multiple integral. Dx1 up to dxk over v. And then an indicator function that's 1 if and only if the elements x1 through xk are arranged in a chain. So it's x1 precedes x2 and so on precedes xk. Okay, that you can work out. I might have stolen this from David Bias, I'm not sure. But anyway, the answer is a little bit messier, but not too bad. K plus 1 over 2 to the K, n factorial to the K, n over 2 factorial over. It is fairly messy, I guess. K, n over 2 factorial. And k plus 1 over 2 n factorial. Of course, when I say factorial, if this happens to be a half integer, you just interpret it in terms of the gamma function. I think that's a kind of common notation. So minus 1 half factorial is the square root of pi. That's the notation. If you specialize this to the other two cases, I mean, there's a check that should get back the other two. And then beyond the chains, the only other one we'll need, this is all for computing the variance of the Mirheim-Meyer dimension estimator, is this V cosine, or whatever you'd like to call it. And that's similar integral. So it's not a triple integral. We're looking at three sprinkled points, so I'll just call them Vx, Dy, Vz, over V, normalized. And now, what we want to indicate is that X is to the past of Y, for example, but also X is to the past of Z. So this is, so I've labeled them in this way. And that one you can also work out. That equals, I won't do this one. I would like, that's a little simpler. 2n, choose n, inverse. And that, of course, by symmetry, since nothing changes if you turn, as far as these definitions go, if you, as far as the sprinkling process goes, if you invert the direction of time, so that will also be the same abundance integral for the lambda, which is the time reverse of the way. By the way, so I assume this notation is standard, right? This choose notation. So I just
do you want to also say that Y and Z are not related?
No, I don't care if they're related. Oh, I see. Not related? No, I don't care if they're related. So I'll still count this in as everything. So it can be. It could be that Z is up here somewhere, which is in fact in the future of one. The only thing that we're requiring, yeah. So I suppose that's a fair statement. So that's really a chain in that case. Good question. But I think you're right. So this not maybe this this terminology is not appropriate in this case. Because we're including some contribution from the chain. Yeah, that's a good point. So, however, this is the integral that we need is this integral. I think it's a misnomer to indicate it like this. So I better put quotes on this one too. And then there's an this is not particularly, we won't, I mean, it's only something that slightly simplifies the calculation, but it's a curious identity that there's, if you look at these formulas, that this three chain one is the product of the two chain and this this one which I now put with quotes, this sort of thing defined by this integral. So now remember, we have defined R was the number of related relations among the sprinkled points. In other words, the number of pairs of points which were related. And we define this estimator of this invariant, which was the relation. Which is the rescaled R, basically R over N choose 2. So R over N times N minus 1. And then from that, we were going to get so-called fractal Mearheim-Meyer dimension of the in the interval to which the causal set is faithfully embedded. So, and we had already, just right at the end of the last time, what we found was using this first integral, the second one, we found that the expectation value of phi, so this expectation value means expectation value with respect to the sprinkling process. So in other words, you sprinkle once, you compute the value for phi, then you sprinkle another n points and throw the first one out, compute another value for phi, that gives you an ensemble of values for phi, and this means it's expectation value. So, with respect to that ensemble, and we have found that that was just equal to this I of that. which I gave you the formula for. So, is there a question? Okay, so let me just indicate briefly how you might compute these intervals. So in this case, it was d to the minus 2 integral dx dy theta of y precedes x. So if I go back to my large interval into which I'm sprinkling, and let this be x, then x, I'll call this 0, just 1. Think of this as being it's t equals 0 and t equals 1. If we call on the x's, whatever, x, y, z, and so on, the spatial coordinates vanishing. So if we call this x, then x together with O also forms an interval. So just a rescaled copy of the larger interval. And if I say that y precedes x, then of course y has to be somewhere in this interval. Use these usual coordinates. So this is t equals 1, this is t equals 0. I'll use these usual coordinates, u equals retarded time, t minus the radius and radial distance, and v is equal to t plus r. Then plugging, if we split this up into the integral over x first, then it's the integral, integral dx over v, v squared here. And when I hold x fixed, what I have is integral over y of a smaller interval, which is just the volume of that interval. So it's the volume of the interval between all of x, right? And the volume, so this is just another interval, so we already know what this is. It's a constant which I call C. What should call it? There's a problem on this page. I've written V instead of M. So I'll try to change it on the fly. If you notice a V anywhere, let me know and I'll change it to M. That's the dimension of the space-time. So that's some constant which I call C sub M times the norm or the length of the proper time between X and O to the N. So we know it has to scale as X to the N, and this is the constant, which I won't bother to rewrite again. And then the rest of this is just some usual V squared outside. The rest of this is just some standard, just some polar coordinates interval, so it's just, this is the volume element in n minus 2. This, by this A, I mean the area of an n minus 2 sphere, r to the Euclidean space, of course, and then du dv over 2, which is like this. That's the two-dimensional area element in terms of u and v coordinates. And then x itself, I mean x squared is uv, as you can see. I mean t squared minus I squared, so that's squared proper time between x and 0, and so that becomes so x to the end of, oops, n over 2. So that's, then you can just finish the, then I'll just leave, I won't bother tracing through the constants, but if you trace through the domain, the proper domains of integration, it's v running from 0 to 1, and u running from 0 to v, and then all these relevant factors which were, oh, I didn't write down what was r. So first we have u, v to the n over 2, and then r if you look at this R as just B minus U, so it'll be just B with some hat for such one. B minus U to the D minus 2, sorry, M minus 2. That you can work out, or you give it to some algebra program, some sort of beta function to something, and it comes out to be just a combinatorial thing again. 3D over 2, or 3N over 2. Choose N. Inwards, as I told you. Okay. Then, if you want to do the integral for, if you want to, this was a kind of induction in which we reduced the problem of doing the two chain to the one chain. The y integral is the one chain, just the value of the sub integral. And so on, if you want to do an n plus one chain, you reduce it. You can do it inductively, reducing it to the n chain. Do not worry about that formula that I gave you before.
Okay.
So that's where this comes from. So now what we want to know, and if you plot this, if you then go and plot this function, I think I drew it right at the end last time. If you plot this expected value of the ordering fraction, actually it's half the ordering fraction.
Why don't you just use the two balls, then everything is left off?
Okay. I thought I might have. Okay. So if we plot this expected value of 5 as a function of the dimension, some monotonically, you can see that this is basically some exponentially growing thing, and asymptotically, so it falls off exponentially to the large end. And it's easy to see that it's monotonic. You can in fact compute the value. So for n equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Let me plot record 2, 5, which is actually the ordering fraction itself. For n, I have no idea what this means, but for n equals 0, it's 3 halves. But so that would be the zero dimensional Minkowski space, whatever that is. And then for n equals 1, it's 1 half. Because in a one dimensional Minkowski space, of course, every no matter how you sprinkle the points, every point is related to every other point. So you get an ordering fraction of 1. For 2, it's 1 half, as we mentioned last time, as you can see by symmetry. For 3, it's 8/35. And for 4, which is the most interesting one, is 1/10, and so on, and then it just falls off. So since it's a monotonic, so the way you would use this estimator, if someone gives you a causal set and says, and then you find an interval in the causal set, and say this causal set was sprinkled into the Minkowski space, or this interval was in a locally flat region of some curve manifold, so that we can use the Minkowski estimate, then you just look at the value of 5, and you go over and see what n does that correspond to, and that's your dimension estimate. So if you work out the ordering fraction and it's 1 half, you say this, if it's near 1 half, you say this must have been a two-dimensional region of the causal set. If you get 1/10, then you say it's four-dimensional and so on. But of course, you're not going to get exactly 1/2 or 1/10. There's going to be some error bars on it. If you sprinkled into exactly 4 dimensions, you won't get exactly 1/10. So if the error bars are too small, are not small enough, then the corresponding spread in the dimension will be so big that you won't know which dimension you're in. So the next question we want to ask is, how small do the errors have to be so that you can reliably recognize the dimension? But of course, what determines the error, this is a statistics thing, we're sprinkling points. So as you can imagine, the more points you sprinkle, the better estimate you'll get. That is, or in the more fundamental way of looking at it, the larger region of space-time we take, the larger interval we take, the more accurate our estimate of the dimension. If we have just a Planckian size interval, we'll get a very terrible estimate. If we have something like 10 to the 1, if we have something like n equals 10 to the 139, then we'll probably get a pretty good estimate. And that, so 10 to the 139 corresponds to about 1 cubic centimeter lasting for 1 second. That's the number of elements if we're around the Planck length. If the fundamental scale is around the Planck scale, for the reasons that Fay mentioned, then you get about this number. So you can anticipate you get a very excellent estimate, but when you're doing computer simulations, you're not going to get numbers like this. You might get, if you're lucky, into the, what can you get? Into the eighth? I don't know. If we're very lucky, we might get something much smaller. So how big do we have to get in order to even be talking about a causal set of four dimensions, for example? Or a causal set, if you want, say, 10 dimensions, it's going to be even worse. So this is the point of this next calculation, just to see how the fluctuations in phi, in this ordering fraction, die off as you increase the number of sprinkled points. And so when they die off small enough so that the uncertainty in n becomes much less than 1, then you'll have a good estimate of the dimension. So what's the condition there? Well, the uncertainty in the here I define, just for convenience, I'm defining another random variable, psi, which is just the log of the ordering fraction, half the ordering fraction. So uncertainty in phi translates down to uncertainty in psi. So if the uncertainty in psi is a certain amount, what does that correspond to in terms of the uncertainty in n? Well, it's just, of course, just depends on the slope between psi and n. So the more rapidly this curve falls off, the easier it is to recognize the difference between one dimension and another. So what we need to, so this will be uncertainty in n. This will, little n, the dimension. This uncertainty, this, I just mean the variance when I write this. Variance of psi. That uncertainty, when that variance gets small, then small enough, then we'll be able to recognize a given dimension. How small it has to be depends on the dimension we're trying to recognize. So let's, instead, I mean, one could do a more careful calculation, but let's just find this for asymptotically. So imagine we're trying to measure dimensions much greater than 1, then the formula is simplified. Okay, so first I'll approximate the psi dn as psi of n plus 2 minus psi of n divided by 2, of course, because I took the 2 just to make the formulas come out more conveniently. So that's 1 half of phi of n plus, because psi was the log of phi, the log, sorry, of psi, phi of n plus 2 over phi of n, and then you can plug those formulas in, and you get, I won't bother with, I'll write one more formula. It's 1 half the log, then the important thing is 4/27, and then there's a whole bunch of things that go to 1 as n gets large. Just give a feeling, I'll write the n plus 1, n plus 2, over n plus 4/3, N plus 2 squared. This S comparatively is just 1/2 log of 4 over 27, which is about 1 minus 1, so it's about 0.955 or something. And even for smaller n, it doesn't vary, so it varies like from 1/2 to 1. Just say minus 1/2. So basically, it's just the number of order 1. So therefore, so the uncertainty in the dimension is then approximately equal. I mean, asymptotically equal to delta psi over 0.96, which means just delta psi itself, basically. And then, because that was a law, delta psi uncertainty in psi is just the uncertainty in phi over phi itself. So that means the estimate is reliable. When delta phi, that is the standard deviation in phi, and certainly in phi is much less than phi itself, the order. So then the only question is when that happens, how large capital N has to be in order for that to happen. So in fact, we can also, so to use this, we need to know how phi itself scales. So we have a picture there, and there's a formula for it somewhere in the word scale, probably over here. But from that formula, using Stirling's approximation, or just from using this fact that we know, just using this estimate that asymptotically the slope of psi, the log of phi is a function of n is constant, but it's falling off exponentially. You can see from that you'll get just a basic behavior of psi going like going like 4/27 to the n over 2. And if you want to be more careful in the Stirling approximation, which I won't use really, there's this prefactor. So this is for n much greater than 1. So all we have to do now is, we have an estimate about how phi grows with n. We know that all we need is that the fluctuations in phi be much smaller than phi itself. They'll, of course, be dying off also with n, and with capital N. But now we need to know how much smaller they need to be. But we need to know what they are, so we know how they're sufficiently small. So we need to find delta phi, which I'm talking about, which I mean the standard deviation, which is delta r over n times n minus 1, because n minus n, n is fixed, and so phi was defined as r over n times n minus 1. So let me indicate to you, what we're going to do now is a kind of typical thing that comes up in many situations, for example, some other work that we did where we're trying to compute the effect of fluctuations in the number of causal set elements on transmission of light through this discrete medium, which is the causal set. Again, you want to know something about the fluctuations in the signal that you receive. And this kind of calculation we're about to do now is the same thing, in effect, and it would be the same for the sort of scalar curvature estimator that Faye will talk about tomorrow. It's just some sort of really just a general situation of statistics. So let's remember, what was the definition? Let's go back now. how we computed phi itself expectation value, and now when we're computing when we computed the expectation value of phi, which is the same thing basically as computing the expectation value of the number of relations. Now let's remember we used a trick, I mean not a trick, but we used the fact that the expectation value of the sum is becoming the expectation value. Now we're going to have to take r squared to get the variance, and now of course the expectation value of a product is not the product of the expectation values, unless the variables are independent, which they are. So this makes life harder. We have to go back and do that. So remember I introduced this indicator variable, dx, dy, which was, this dx was a little region of the interval, and dy was a little region of the interval. I'd introduced that, assuming that x precedes, and the indicator variable is 1, if and only if x precedes y, and dx is occupied and dy is occupied. So if I've sprinkled a point here and I've sprinkled a point here, and those two points are causally related, then this is 1. In that case, there's a contribution to that definite as a relation, and that's a contribution to R. And then R itself is a sum over all such pairs of little vectors, or whatever you call the higher, still don't know what you call the higher dimensional analogs of vectors, over all such pairs. So let's see, now what does that tell us about its variance? So I'm going to, just for, I can't think of a better notation to do this calculation. I'm going to give each one of these pairs, x, comma, y, a name. I'll just call it A, B, C, and so on. But this sum is just that sum with each term in the sum given a name. What we want in order to compute the variance, standard, and therefore the standard deviation, we want the deviation from the mean squared. So let's look, and then the expectation value of that. So let's look at the deviation from the mean. So that's, so remember, so A just means basically the number of, it's 1 if there's a relation here and 0 otherwise, so it's a random variable. So if I take this is just the sum of these random variables, so if I subtract off its mean, because the sum of the mean is the mean of the sum, so that's B minus the mean of B plus B minus the mean of C, etc. So when I have to take this thing squared now, I'll be doing the same thing with squared. So I'll take this squared plus this squared. I mean, I'll square this whole expression, right? And then that'll split into two kinds of contributions, the diagonal ones and the off-diagonal ones. And so the first one will be the sum, the diagonal ones will be the sum over all these what I call A's, which are each A is just one of these little, I don't know what to call them, pairs of plaquettes. A minus A, yeah, A minus A bar squared, and then there'll be the off diagonal when I'm looking at two different pairs of points. So that's the sum of A not equal to B of A minus the mean of A times B minus the mean of B. Now what can we say about, so first of all, what is A squared? Oh, well, let me expand this out. So, let me use the, as always happens, this in computing standard deviations. This, of course, now we want the mean of this thing. When we take the mean, we get the mean of this. That's always, as you can trivially check, it's the mean of A squared minus square of the mean of A. And in the same way, the second sum, these are these correlators. It's A, it's the mean of AB minus the mean of A times the mean of B. This is just like the one half line calculation. There are four terms, but three of them can. You've probably seen this before, but if you haven't seen it before, it's very easy to check. Now, what can we say about this? About these individual things. So, what was A? Remember, A was just the name for one of these indicator functions, which is a random variable that's either 0 or 1. Which one if there's a, you know, one. It's telling whether you actually did get a related pair from that pair of plaquettes. So since it's either 0 or 1, its square is itself. It's an idempotent one. Because 0 squared is 0 and 1 squared is 1. So we don't need this square. We can take that away. And this one, we'll see this in more detail in a closely related thing. But the mean of this is sort of scaling like the volume of the little region, of course, dx. But we've squared that. This is a dx squared. When we sum over all, when we do the sum, it's going to be managed. So, as I said, we should see it's the same effects explicitly below. And then, yes, the rest, I guess we can't say anything about. So, with those substitutions, we're just left with the sum over A of the mean of A, but then now we can take the mean outside. So it's the mean of the sum of the A's, but the sum of the A's is just R. So this is just the mean of R, which we've already computed. And then there's the part, the new part, that we can't do much with. Just have to rewrite it instead of A not equal to C. The expectation value of A and B minus the expectation of A times the expectation of B. Okay, so any questions? Yes.
Sorry, why is the expectation value of A vanish when you sum over all A? Can you just explain?
I'll come back to that.
Okay.
No, I didn't say that. Did I say that?
Well,
this one, the expectation value of A is square. It's the square of the expectation value.
Okay.
Otherwise, it wouldn't vanish. It would just be this R.
But isn't A just going to be a 0 or 1 anyway?
It will, but its expectation will not.
Yes, but why would the square... Okay, I'll follow.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Why would the square not?
So A is a 0 or a 1.
Yeah.
But its expectation value will be of order... will be of order delta x squared, delta x times delta y in this case. Because this is... You know, what is the expectation of a variable? If the random variable is 0 or 1, what is its expectation value? It's just the product, the probability that it equals 1. Mm-hmm. The expectation value of A, it's equal for any variable. It's the probability that A equals 1 times 1 plus the probability that A equals 0 times 0 plus whatever values it might assume. But in this case, it's just 0 and 1. So this is, and that's just equal to the probability that A equals 1. So for an indicator variable like this, the expectation value is just the probability that it is 1. But the probability that this is 1, in order for this to be 1, these have to be related. But the most important thing is that you have to sprinkle, a point actually has to get sprinkled into this little plaquette, and a point has to get sprinkled into that little plaquette. So the probability of getting a point is scaling like the dx. And the probability of getting a point here is scaling like dy. And so it's going to scale like dx dy. When you square it, it's going to scale like dx squared. And so it's going to go like dx dy. And when we square it, that's right. When we square it, it's going to go like that squared. And when we take an integral dx dy, if you integrate this, then you have sort of dx dy coming out in front, so to speak. When you sum this, it goes over to an integral dx dy, but with an extra dangling factor of dx dy. So the limit it goes to 0.
Okay.
So this is the expectation value of R, which is already computed. So now we have to do, if we were to do this in full, we'd have to do five cases. I'm not going to try and do all the cases, depending on how these two A and B are related. Remember, each A and B seems to have lost. Each A and B is something of this form. We've excluded the case where A equals B, so that's not there, but there are still five cases left over, which I can indicate. This is where these, why we need these other integrals. So these are five cases for A not being B. So the pair, like I say, is not the pair of B, and here's what the cases can look like. So they can look like this, where A is this pair, and B is this pair. Or they can look like, are these two lower elements can coincide, two lower plaquettes, I'll just call them plaquettes even though they're higher dimensional in general. They can coincide, but the upper one's different. And that's the same kind of the same outcome, obviously. So you're going to get the same contribution as when the upper one's coinciding, the lower one's different. And then they could be concatenated like this, so this could be A and this could be, so the top of one could coincide with the bottom of the other, and that'll obviously yield the same result, same number, as when you turn the other way around. And so there's really only three distinct ones that we have to do, and these are these two. And as I said, the fourth possibility would be that both the upper and lower plaquettes coincide. But we've already taken that. That's the contribution from this part of the sum. So that's not here. So it's a little bit confusing. You have these kind of infinitesimal regions, and you wouldn't think that it matters whether one of them exactly overlaps the other or not, but it actually makes a significant difference to the answer. That's the kind of tricky part, which I've certainly more than once said, oh, we can ignore that and got the wrong answer. So you can't ignore it. You have to. We'll see why. It's basically because of this factorism. It's related to that discussion that we just had about why this contribution does vanish. So let me do this.
And again, in the middle two possibilities, they're not necessarily a...
Not, and
the
that's right.
The subproduct is not
these,
necessarily that.
Yes, that's not really
but
that causal. Yeah, so all I really mean is that this coincides with this and this one. Yeah, that's right. So there's a thing that's a bad, yeah. And so,
they just share them and that's
a misleading diagram. So all I'm trying to say is there's a pair of plaquettes here and there's a pair of plaquettes here, but these two plaquettes are the same one. So that's the contribution to the sum when they're equal. But there's no implication that this is necessarily space-like.
So it includes a three-chain where A is the top and bottom, and B is the middle of the bottom. We're counting this.
I think so. I'll have to think about it afterwards. Maybe there's... So there is some overcounting going on here. In the asymptotic expression that we're going to get, all the contribution is going to come from this. This is going to be subleading. So it won't affect the asymptotic answer. It's conceivable that if you want the subleading terms, there might be a mistake in this, the way I've set it up. I'll have to think about it.
Well, we would, if you write down the integral for that contribution from such things, then you can see whether it includes those regions.
Yeah. point is, yes, I think the point is it won't include. Let me think about it, but let's take the time now. I think this is probably okay, but I'm more confident that it's okay in the asymptotic numbers. So let's. Just to go through one of them in detail, some detail, let me do this one as an example. I'll give these little placards names, dx, dy, and dz. So for the contribution from that one, we needed, remember, these are all these terms here, so we need a, b, we need to compute the product's expectation value minus the product of the expectation values. So the first one is just, if we go back to what this was chi dx dy times chi, it's the product of the two chi's, dx dz, so it's part of, this was I think called A and this was B. So this is the chi of A corresponding to A and this is the chi of B. That's equal to the, so what does that mean in words? What is this? This is one, so we have these three, these are these little plaquettes here. So more square. This is one when there's a point. Now I'll take it for granted that this does causally precede this, and this does causally precede this. Then this first indicator function contributes when this is occupied and this is occupied, the x and the y, and the second indicator function contributes when x and z are both occupied, not otherwise. So the product contributes if and only if all three of them are occupied. Right? And so that's equal just the probability of full occupation. And then as before, the probability we get the first one occupied is just n over v times dx, its volume. Once you've used up the first point, there's n minus 1 left, and so you get n minus 1 over v. And once you've used those two, two are left, and so you have n minus 2 over v times dz. That's that. To be summed over all the x, y, and z, and that'll, all the triples, that'll of course turn into a triple integral. Then as far as then I need the expectation value of A itself, which is the expectation, so that's dx, dy, expectation value, and that's something, now this will get more detailed answer to your question. We'll see the same thing going on. I won't bother to work out exactly what this is because the important thing is it's proportional to dx dy. When I come to compute b, I'll have this dy dz. That'll be proportional to dy dz. So therefore, when I multiply these two together, I'll get a times b is proportional to dx. Did I think?
Yes.
This was dx, is that what? I'll get something proportional to dx squared, dy, dz. When I sum this, when I put this into the sum over x, y, and z, it'll look like a triple integral, but with one dangling factor of dx. I mean, so in other words, the contributions are falling off faster than the number. One extra power. So that'll go to zero. So I can just neglect those. Therefore, the contribution from this particular configuration will be n times n minus 1 times n minus 2 times the integral. This sum will then put here a sum, and that'll convert into in the limit of small, fairly small plaquettes, that'll convert into the integral dx, dy, dz of this thing. Right? So that'll be, I should probably write that explicitly. That'll convert into when I sum all of these things, it'll go to integral dx over v, dy over v, etc. And again, it's in this pattern when there's this restriction on the domain of the integration. And so that's what we called I. So it's n times n minus 1 times n minus 2 times what we called I, this pattern. It's not what's coincided, but it's part of the notation.
Okay.
So that's the result for this particular contribution to the sum. And for, I think since I don't want to take too much more time, taking more time than I wanted, I was going to say a little bit about the other terms, but let me just cut to the asymptotic form. So we have all the ingredients there. We have the form for the integral. You can plug them in and estimate the result. What you find is that delta r squared, which is what we've been computing here, the expectation value of delta r, the square, so the square of the, basically the square of the uncertainty in the ordering fraction of the number of relations, that's defined to be r minus r expectation value squared expectation. What we find for that is that it's 2 asymptotically for a large number of sprinkled points. You get this integral plus this integral, the 3-chain integral, minus twice the 2-chain integral squared times, the important thing here is the n cubed, the number of sprinkled points, and then it goes to infinity. So delta r itself is scaling like, take the square root, is scaling like n to the 3 halves. This is a little strange. To me it was. I was expecting, I did expect, I wasn't sure what to expect, but the most straightforward guess would be that it would be scaling like the square root of r itself. I mean, you know, if you have a sum of a large number of small contributions and they're all independent, you get square root of n scaling in the fluctuations. That's the main fact about statistics or something. And so this, in this case, r itself is scaling like n squared. So you might have expected the fluctuations to scale like n. But in fact, they scale like n to the 3 halves, which is, so the correlations have somehow amplified the fluctuations. But it's still smaller than r itself, of course. So in the limit, a very large n, the fluctuations get very small. And if you, let's suppose that now, since we're computing everything for large dimension, let the dimension little n go to infinity. So far, if I kept all the terms, this calculation is exact. If you do that, you find delta r goes asymptotically like 2 to the minus n times, which is the 2 minus little n, is the coefficient of this n to the 3 halves. Therefore, delta phi, which is just equal to delta r, the uncertainty in r over n times n minus 1, that was the definition of phi, r over n minus 1, that just feels like 4 to the minus n over 2 over the square root of n, 1 over n squared. I just wrote 2 to the minus n is 4 to the minus n over 2, because then I can say delta phi over phi. This is the thing that we're really interested in, the ratio of the uncertainty in phi to phi itself. So that's this ratio of this, for, and then phi itself we saw before, it's going like that, 4 to the 27 to the n over 2. So when you take the ratio of those two, it goes like 4 to the minus n over 2 over the square root of n I'm just rewriting things that are already on the board, n over 2. And that goes like 1 over the square root of n times 27 sixteenths to the n over 27 sixteenths to the n over 2. Therefore, so when is delta phi over phi? So finally we can answer our question. When is g delta phi over phi much less than 1, and certainty in phi much less than, uncertainty in the ordering fraction much less than the ordering fraction itself, if and only if this right-hand side is much less than 1, which means that n is much greater than 27 sixteenths to the n. So that's the main result. If you want to reliably recognize a dimension of little n, you need, I mean, this 27 sixteenths is really almost like 2, it's just slightly smaller than 2. So basically you need about 2 to the n elements to, for causal sets to be able to be said to have a dimension, Riemann-Meier dimension of around little n. So are there any questions on the sort of meaning of that result, what the result is, the details of the calculus?
Do you mean mean phi, delta phi, or the mean phi?
Literally, yes, strictly speaking, I mean.
So
you might say, I think this is remarkably good. That means that the Mirheim-Meyer dimension is about as good as you could possibly imagine. In fact, it's even a little better than I would imagine, because it's 27 sixteenths instead of 2. And if you say, suppose I want to make a little three-dimensional object, some discrete, let's not worry that it's a causal set. How would I, you think, what would I make a little, and you know, if I had some graph or something, it seems like you'd need at least a little square to call it two-dimensional, and that would be already 4 elements. If you wanted to make a little three-dimensional thing, you'd think you need a little cube or something like that. And that would be 8. So in general, it's hard to believe that you would get by with fewer than 2 to the n elements to describe an n-dimensional object. And here we're actually getting by with slightly fewer. So, as I said, I can't imagine that any other dimension estimator would do significantly better than this. If you do some simulations on it, then there are many other dimension estimators which I won't talk about, but many have been proposed. And this one seems to do as well as any of the others. In another second, I'll mention one that does atrociously. That's the word that gives the worst results of anything. But in sizes of causal sets you can actually deal with. But in principle, in an infinite limit, it's a beautiful one. But anyway, this one has this behavior. So it means if you wanted to do four-dimensional simulations, which is, of course, what we want to do, you're not up to a very large number, because if you took this literally, you only need 16 points, which is not quite that. You won't get anywhere with 16 elements. But it shows that you're not sort of beyond the realm of, beyond the reach. But on the other hand, if you wanted to do 11, if you're thinking of M theory or something, and you want to do on the causal set, whatever that is, and you want to do then you're up to 2 to the 11, that's already pretty, that's already 2,000 elements, and then you really need more, and then you're getting pretty much beyond the limits of what anything but a supercomputer cluster or something can happen. So let me just mention one other, dimension estimator, which is, just mention it. But here's my sprinkled interval in here. instead of counting the number of relations, let me count the number of chains called that C. That grows exponentially, and you can show that the following thing, if I can, I think it's the log of the number of elements. I might have it inverted, but I think it's the log of the number of elements over the log of the number of chains converges to the dimension independently of dimension. That's why this is a beautiful estimator. It's universal. You don't need to invert some complicated function or something. You just compute this and it gives you the dimension. But what do we have here? So if you do this log, I mean, C could be this log, you know, 2 to the 30 or something. If you just imagine and computed that thing, the log of that is, well, you know, it's around 30 or something, and the log of that. So log is something that I think you can never see in an actual, you can never do justice to in a computer simulation. So although this is beautiful in principle, in practice, it's fairly worthless, unfortunately. And so there are other dimension estimators, and one of the criteria for something being like a manifold is for the different dimension estimators to agree with each other. But let me not talk about them. Instead, let's slightly review what we've found. We found here an estimator for dimension. Beethoven talked about an estimator for distance. It's come up many times. So that's time-like distance. I put an exclamation point because it turns out to be remarkably hard to get an estimator for space-like distance. That's related to the Lorentzian signature. And then one other thing is topology. Of course, when I say topology, the dimension is itself an aspect of topology, but I mean more details like homology, you know, whether there are handles in the space, or non-contractible curves, and so on. So David and some collaborators have done that for a slice, so that's the topology of a slice, which, remember, was a maximal anti-chain. Playing the role of a space-like hypersurface. So if you had a causal set that was well approximated by a space-time with a non-trivial spatial topology, like is often considered in connection with geons and other things in the continuum theory, then here's something, there's a way of getting information about that topology out too. So that's kind of all I want to say about kinematics, except one raise a couple of questions and say one last prediction. So, of course, quantum gravity is not known for a surplus of predictions that can be compared with experiment. So here's one, although you'll see that the experiments have perfectly confirmed this prediction so far. And I'll mention the other one. I used to say that for those who know baseball terminology, which is probably no one, I used to say quantum gravity was betting 1,000 because it made one prediction and one prediction came true. But now I see there's actually a second prediction I forgot about. And then someone pointed out to me that it made a wrong prediction. So it's really betting 666, I guess. So, anyway, it's a very good betting error. But it's based on only 3 at bats, so I don't think we shouldn't crow about it too much. But here's the prediction is that there are no causal loops, no closed time-like curves in space-time. Well, how can we predict that? Well, it's very simple because when we define causal set, we have the condition of acyclicity. So that's precisely the statement that there should be no causal loops. So I'm sure you're very impressed now, since we put in an axiom that said there are no causal loops, and we concluded that there were no causal loops. But it's not really a joke. Really what it's trying to say is that the kind of structure that a causal set is cannot be generalized to allow for causal loops. That's really what we're saying. So if the microscopic structure is a discrete order, then you just can't describe a space-time with causal loops. So let me just indicate why that is. Suppose that there were, but now I can't use a Hasse diagram because a Hasse diagram is designed to not have causal loops. Time just runs up. So I have to use the arrows. I mean, I can't draw it as a, in the usual way. I have to make the arrows explicit. So suppose you had elements A, B, C, D, or something, and so on, that formed a loop, a causal loop. Now, causality, so we have to think a more general, we have to say, well, couldn't we just generalize the notion of causal set to allow for this? We have the reciprocity axiom, let's just drop it. The one that we can't drop, at least I have no idea how to drop, is the axiom of transitivity. Because the very notion of causality is inherently transitive. If A can influence B and B can influence C, then A can influence C. If there's a causal curve from A to B and from B to C, then there's a, by putting them together, there's a causal curve from A to C. So we can't drop transitivity. Suppose we drop A, we can drop acyclicity. So what, but what will happen then? If we say that A precedes B, B precedes C, C precedes D, and D precedes A, then we also find that any two of these elements precede each other, right? Because you can just run around until you find. But it's even worse, that's all right. Maybe. I mean, that's not so good already, but it's even worse than that, because take any third element, that's maybe somewhere else, element X, then we will find that if we drop A, if we have this cycle here, that A precedes X, if and only B precedes X, if and only C precedes X, etc. Why is that? Well, suppose B precedes X, okay? Well, then by transitivity, A precedes B precedes X. And also by transitivity, C precedes D precedes A precedes B precedes X. So if any one of these precedes X, all of them precedes X. If any of them doesn't precede X, none of them precede X. If X precedes any of them, it precedes all of them. So as far as X is concerned, it can't see the difference between any of these elements. They just collapse, in, as you like, into a single element. But if what you have in mind is, if you now ask, could this be well approximated by a space-time with a causal loop in it, like this is just periodically identified in Minkowski space, the answer is no, because A might be here, B might be here, C might be here, X might be here, for example. So X is close to C, it's not close to B, it's not close to A. But some X sees C, A, B, and C differently. But in this setup, X has to see A, B, and C, and D all the same. It can't see the difference between them, because all it has to go on is the relationship itself. Okay, so that's the argument. So it means that things like Stephen Hawking's chronology protection conjecture should have been expected to be true. Which was, people have tried to imagine worlds in which there are causal loops, and then the question is whether it's even a self-consistent idea. It could, of course, be a self-consistent idea and not be consistent with causal sets, but to the extent that causal sets are realistic, at least gives a hint that you should expect the idea not to be self-consistent, and then in any case not to be realized in nature. So that's the last, the first prediction, and the last thing I want to say about kinematics, except to, let me just, in fact, I won't even say those. So let me go to the next topic, which is supposed to be most of this lecture, which is the classical sequential growth models. And to do that, in preparation for that, I have to make one more kinematic definition. That is, one definition just having to do with the general structure of causal sets, not yet the dynamics. This will function like a kind of arena for the dynamics of sequential growth. And we've given it, I want to define another post-set. This is not a dynamical post-set, it's not a causal set, but it's a post-set that's related to the structure of an arbitrary causal set, which we call post-cal. I think David introduced this term, but it stands for the post-set of causal sets. So suppose a set of all finite causal sets can be given an order themselves, And that gives you a completely different partial order, but related of course, which we call Bosco. So let me introduce what that means. Remember, we sometime we talked about the small, just to get a feeling, the structure of small causal sets. So here's a causal set of zero, of one element. Here's a causal set of zero elements. Here's a causal set of one element. And I've drawn a line between, I'll say exactly why in a second. Here's a causal set of two elements, a two chain. Here's a causal set, the other causal set of two elements, the anti-chain. Here's a causal set of three elements, looks kind of like an L. There's this B causal set, and there's this two chain. So I'm doing all, there's all five of the three orders. And now I'm going to arrange these into a diagram. It's that diagram that we call Bosco. So what's the meaning of this arrangement? And how do I know when to draw this line? So the idea is I draw a link in this Bosco between two causal sets. If I could get the second one, the child, this is called the parent and this is the child, if I could get the child by a single birth happening in addition to the birth that gave rise to the parent. So in other words, if I could adjoin to the parent causal set a single element to produce another causal set, and that element is maximal, then I draw a link. So for example, in this case, I start with an anti-chain. This is the new element that I've joined, right? So I have an anti-chain here. Then say this, in this sequential growth, these will represent births. So these two are born. Then another one is born, and it has these two as its ancestor. So in one step, in one stage of this process that we'll be talking about, we can go from here to here. When that's the case, we draw a link between them. In this diagram, that's the meaning of this diagram. Here's another one. So from this, I could do the same thing. I could add a new element, which is a maximal element, and I get something like that. So this can be continued forever, of course, and it gets wider very, very rapidly because of the growth in the number of positive sets. But this itself is a poset. And it plays a crucial role in the description of this classical sequential growth model, which was supposed to be the main content of today. So what should I do now? So let me say a couple of words about it and what it does, what you can learn from it, and let me say a few words about dynamics in general. So far we've been talking about kinematics. I think broadly you can say there are two approaches to constructing a dynamical theory, a dynamics for a theory. One in particular for dynamics for the causal set. One I've called the principled approach because it's based on principle, and the other one, just by way of contrast, I'll call the opportunistic approach. In this lectures, I'll represent the principled approach and they will represent the opportunistic and beyond will represent the opportunistic approach. So I won't say much about that. But the thing that I have in mind is, say, the history of general relativity. So if you think, how did people arrive at the Einstein equations? Well, I don't know the literal history, but one way you could imagine arriving at them is by principles. So there are principles like general covariance. there's a principle that the basic gravitational field and space kind of inertial structure and such should be described by geometry. This is really a kinematic decision. It's a decision on what the kinematic should be. And then you have to say the dynamic should be generally both. That's sort of a kinematic pair. Then you add some other conditions, like you should describe the dynamics by field equations. That's one could imagine other ways of defining dynamics. But say you want to do that by partial differential equations. Well, then, in fact, if these equations should be partial differential equations, that's a principle of locality. You might say that they should be second order in the derivatives. If you maybe there's some other things you have to add, I'm not sure. If you put all this together, you're led more or less uniquely to the Einstein equations. That's what I mean by principle approach. So the question is, to what extent can we follow a similar path? The other approach, the opportunistic approach, is to say, well, we had Newtonian gravity, we had something like gravitational potential, we had Poisson's equation before it. Can we just play around and find some differential equation that reduces the Poisson's, that involves the metric that reduces the Poisson's equation to an appropriate limit, and so on. That is another way you could have been led to the Einstein equation. Although without general covariance, I think it's pretty hard. If you don't add in at least this principle, you have a very hard time arriving at those particular equations. So that's what I meant by more, that's what I meant by not contrastal point of view or approach. If you follow this principle path, then you'll be led, or we were led, to this classical sequential ghost dynamics. That's what I wanted to describe. If you follow the other kind of path, you ask yourself, which is of course an important question anyway, you ask yourself, how could I write something like the Einstein Hilbert Lagrangian for a positive set? Can I play around and find something that'll do that? And today we'll talk about that tomorrow. So for today let's be principal. So that leaves this classical sequential growth. That's phase tomorrow. Now notice the C here, that's classical sequential growth. What we end up with is a stochastic process that describes the development of the causal set in time. But of course time is part of the causal set itself. So what we're actually describing is the growth of the causal set by addition of elements, which you can call birth. So it's a birth process, stochastic birth process, but it's classical. So, of course, we would like to be quantum, but as a warm-up, we took the classical case first. And there's some philosophical point of view behind this, which is that ultimately we're looking for a path integral. Like object, of course, it's a path sum for the causal set, but something like a path integral for the causal set. And that the idea, if you think of quantum mechanics in terms of Hamiltonian, in terms of the Schrödinger equation, then the natural classical analog is Hamiltonian dynamics, which is deterministic. If you think of quantum mechanics in terms of the path integral, which is the only one that seems to go with a discrete space-time structure, then the natural analog of it is not Hamiltonian dynamics, classical Hamiltonian dynamics, but it's classical stochastic process. In fact, mathematically, there's hardly any distinction in the formalism between the path integral and classical stochastic process. In fact, by Wick rotation, you turn one into the other, and you will start to do practical calculations, end up doing something that's much more classical statistical mechanics calculation instead of a quantum one. So that's kind of the philosophy behind that. So the thought is, if we can produce something like a classical stochastic process for describing the causal set dynamics, then that'll be a big step in the direction of finding a quantum stochastic process. And a quantum stochastic process is quantum mechanics from the point of view of that. So that's the perspective. Resulting, so this is CSG equals classical stochastic growth. And I'll add the word model, because of course this is a model, toy models people say. We're not thinking of it as being actual quantum gravity sensing. It's not quantum. Let me list what it's about falling and what you do. Let them do two things. Let me list the analyze theorem of these things, of these inputs, these principles that we're using, and tell you, make some claims about what you can learn from when you finish constructing this process. So I claim that it illuminates the following thing. The first thing that it does is to give us it shows us how we can write down the dynamics for causal sets without inducing any background. So they're not embedded in some space-time or something. It's just an intrinsic, what you might call intrinsic dynamics for causal sets. Actually, my co-lecturer told me she doesn't like this word, background impact, but I forgot to ask her why, so but anyway, I like this word. She likes that one, intrinsic. So, in other words, it doesn't rely on some other structures in order to define the dynamics. So that's a perennial problem in quantum gravity. I mean, think of string theory, for example, it's very far from being like this, because to define a string theory, you need to assume some space-time in which the string propagates, even though you have in mind that ultimately that space-time has built itself from the string. You have no idea how to do that, and you just assume it as a background. So here we have a fully background-independent or intrinsic kind of dynamical law. Another thing that it does, as part of that, I think, is a background-independent notion, a background-independent or an intrinsic causality criterion. That's also very, very difficult, because causality, relativistic causality, tends to mean that two space-like things can't communicate with each other. But how do you know if they're space-like or not until you have the causal structure? So, causal structure is dynamical, you might imagine that you would get into a kind of circle where you can't specify this in some coherent way. It turns out that you can in this context, and that's what we call Bell causality. And it's the thing that corresponds or takes place of, this is Bell, takes the place of the locality, which, as we remarked many times, is not at all available for causal sets. Here's a crucial thing. It overcomes the entropic catastrophe. What do I mean by the entropic catastrophe? Well, it's the fact that it's this thing that you've just been discussed, I think, a few times privately. I don't know if it came up exactly in the, after the lecture. I'm not sure if it came up in the lecture or not. But we saw the extremely rapid growth of the number of elements, of causal sets, of the number of elements. Remember, for n elements, you can make reflectivity and square it over 4. And most of them are nothing like a space-time. If we're going to get a space-time out, we need to overcome this tremendous burst that the causal set would have if left to its own devices to be one of these two-layer or three-layer causal sets. It could be the action or the Lagrangian or some amplitude in the path integral that overcomes that. And it's hard to imagine how that can be in a local theory. In fact, it's more or less clear that in a local theory you can't do that, because the kind of typical local actions only grow like e to the n, not n squared. They can't compensate this. But because this causal sets are non-local, the intrinsic dynamics of causal sets is also non-local. And the ones that you're led to, these classical sequential growths, actually produce causal sets that are nothing like these two or three layer orders. They're much more like space-time. Unfortunately, they're not completely like space-time, but in any case, entropic catastrophe is closely related to the cosmological constant problem. I won't say why, because we're really running out of time. Last, so I'll just put two more things. So it leads to very interesting cosmological scenarios. Including such things as the people have often speculated about, but didn't have a precise framework for discussing. This one is a cosmological renormalization group. That is to say, that the cosmos collapses and then expands again. You get a new theory, a new effective set of coupling constants for each cycle of expansion, and it has actually a line of fixed points. And it tends to drive you to things that are more resemble the universal rhythm. Anyway, I just don't have time. And not cycling universe, that's part of the set. That's the same scenario. And then finally, well, this is an input, but it's an idea that's not much in evidence in other approaches, most fundamental physics, but it's very natural for the causal set, which is dynamics as growth, as a growth process. So, and then finally, it solves. Solves the problem of time. I left that out. It solves the so-called problem of time. And in particular, it is a world. It's a world that has. This is now. This last thing is on a philosophical level. It has a concept of asynchronous becoming. So what this is to do. This is for those who are familiar with this debate. There's some sort of so-called block universe versus whatever the opposite is called. It's like, does relativity teach us that the world is just some static four-dimensional object that's there eternally, and our impression of time passing is just an illusion? Or is there something real in nature corresponding to the passage of time? Here there is, which is the first. And it's sort of a counterexample to claims that many people have made, that relativity is a four-dimensional world is incompatible with the idea of actual change, that things really happen. So that's the list. To arrive at general relativity, we have this. To arrive at causal sets, the first kinematic input is that, of course, we're dealing with the causal set. General covariance has a natural analog, which is label invariance. Because what does general covariance mean? It just means that nothing really depends on the coordinates that you might introduce to describe space-time. In the same way, you might introduce labels to describe the causal sets, as we've been doing. Label invariance is the statement that physics shouldn't depend on it. This will correspond in the set classical sequential growth is labeled, of course, by the order of births, which will be order of arrival in this. The birth process will be like an upward pass through this diagram, succession of births. Corresponding to field equations, we'll have the transition probabilities that describe. We'll have the fact that the sequential birth is described by transition probabilities. And we'll see that the consequence of general covariance is that that has to be actually what's called the Markov process, which produces a great simplification in the theory and allows you to essentially solve for all possible growth models. What corresponds to second order, we don't know. And there's another principle, which we call internal temporality. Sorry, this is becoming so electrical. But anyway, another principle which we call internal temporality. And I don't know what that corresponds to on the GR side. But what it means is that we're going to think of this as a succession of births. So I think suppose we had built up this causal set, say the three chains, succession of births. If this were to be born first, and this second, and this third, that's going opposite of the direction of time. It doesn't make sense. It's the real physical meaning of time is what's given in this causal order itself. So this internal temporality condition is that when a new element is born, it'll have some of the others to its past, other space-like, but it'll never be born to the past of any other. So those are the main ingredients that we're providing for to construct this dynamic. Any questions? Yeah.
Could you comment a bit more on how this solves the problem of time without taking this external time that you use to grow the causal seriously?
Right. So that's the key part. So we introduce an external time. But then we introduce this catalog of general covariance, this invariance principle, which says that none of the probabilities that you compute should depend on the choice of the external time. So in other words, if I was growing this causal set, it could be grown, there's three orders in which the elements might have been born consistently with this internal temporality. The first one, this could have come first, the second, say, and this third. Or this could have come first, the second, and this third. And those would correspond to different paths to this foxtrot. So if this one, came first, and this second, first one element was born, then this one, then you follow this path, and then finally that one was born, so you follow this. On the other hand, if I let that was 0, 1, 2, on the other hand, if I let, that was 0, 1, 2, on the other hand, if I follow this order, 0, 1, 2, this bar and this bar, then I would get 0, of course. I would have followed that path. So these are two distinct paths to arrive at the same one. And they correspond to a different choice of how this developed in the external time. But the external time is not supposed to be physically real. So to put it, we require that the probability to arrive via this path and the probability to arrive via this be equal, so this general covariance, this discrete general covariance as we call it, in terms of growth as an upward path through post growth corresponds to path independence of probabilities. And you can build, and you just build that in these conditions. Once you have this path independence, then it turns out you can describe all of these in terms of Markov process with transition amplitudes on each neighbor as possible. And then you can analyze further. But once you have that, then then you have completely. So this, the idea is that there is an external time here, but it's purely gauged, to be regarded as purely gauged. The only physically meaningful notion of time that survives is the one intrinsic of the causal sense. So that's, now you said, how does this solve the problem of time? So what is the raises in that form? So I'm not sure how you were thinking of the problem of time. But when people say the problem of time, what they usually mean, I think more often than not, they're thinking of canonical quantum theory. They're thinking that, as you might know, you've got the so-called Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is an equation for a wave function that lives only on space. More precisely, it's a function out that takes space-like metrics, spatial metrics into complex numbers. It attaches an amplitude to every three geometries. But three geometries are not space-time, they're only space. So that in the context of canonical quantum gravity, there's a most glaring problem of time, which is how do we get time back? We live in a world in which it's described by space-time, not just by space. But the theory is giving us only space. So that's sort of the first and most curious problem of time. It's only, that, however, is only a problem for an approach that starts with space, which was a canonical approach. So that's solved trivially because we're starting with the structure of time. Then, however, there are subtle problems of time. I don't know, am I giving you more answer than you want? I'm not sure. There are subtle problems of time that are not automatically resolved by us. I can say something more later about them. They have to do with finding physically comprehensible observables compatible with general covariance. How do you talk about things when everything that you say has to be given work is not learned and you have no background time to refer to these two? So there's a whole issue with any theory of quantum gravity, except ones that explicitly violate the view of work and moments. And I have to say how that sounds is a little more subtle. But it requires some you have to prove the theorem to show that it's fully solved. But the basic way that we solve it is to identify a set of questions or events, as they're called in the probability language, a set of questions that you can ask about the causal set whose physical meaning is clear, and such that all covariant questions that you could have asked are logical combinations of those questions. And what are those questions? Those questions are basically about what we call stems. So they're basically questions about, was there ever a stage in the rows at which the causal set looked like this? With an appropriate label. So a more invariant way of saying it is, does a given causal set, finite causal set, occur? You know, after the whole process has run, you imagine at quantum infinity, you produce some infinite, countably infinite, but you produce an infinite causal set. How do you ask questions meaningfully about this without using labels? That's the problem of time, or the residual problem, as far as this result is most very, very, very important. This is still a very important problem. So the answer is you ask a question, you think something like this, and you say, can I find this ever, anywhere in the causal set, as a step? A step on a step means that it's a task set, it's and finite. So it contains all its own answers. So is there somewhere in the causal set where I can find this? With it being a complete stem, that nothing is. So I'm not saying, can I find one here, one here, and one here, that are arranged like a diagram, but I'm saying, can to be the earliest possible time. That's what we call that a step. The question, does this exist? Can we find this? Then can we find that? Can we find that? You go through all possible finite causal steps. You get a countable number of questions that you could ask about, all of which have a clear physical meaning and are manifested covariance questions. They don't depend on how you've labeled the other. And it turned out that those questions from a complete set in a certain sense. That's the more sort of refined solutions, solutions are more refined problem. Any other questions? Okay, so tomorrow we'll be back, and for the last lecture we'll be back downstairs.